Welcome back to the program as we turn our attention right now to the economic crisis that we're facing. And amidst the housing collapse, the rise in energy costs, and our increasingly dysfunctional healthcare system, one of the other things that America's working poor are battling is simply the ability to put food on the table. We're going to talk about this with a guest that has been with us before. It is a pleasure to have him back. He is Sasha Abramsky. He's a senior fellow with the New York-based think tank Demos. His writings have appeared in numerous publications, including The Atlantic Monthly, Rolling Stone, and The Nation. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his newest book, Breadline USA, The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger and How to Fix It. Sasha Abramsky, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
How serious is the problem of hunger in America today?
Well, it's very serious, and I think people underestimate it because we don't see visual images of hunger in the same ways as, let's say, in the Ethiopian famine, there were these televised images of malnourished, starving children. We don't have that here. What we have is this chronic hunger epidemic where for many tens of millions of people, they cannot afford to buy enough food. It doesn't mean they're going hungry in the end. It might mean they're falling back on government programs. It might mean they're falling back on private charities. They're going to food banks, food pantries. They're going to churches. But the one thing it definitely does mean is that they're worried about food, very chronically anxious about how they're going to feed themselves and how they're going to feed their children. They're skimping on meals. They're eating less quality food. They're eating more junk food and fast food that's cheap and filling but deeply unhealthy. And that all comes together to create a tremendous societal problem. So in answer to your question, it's a big issue.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent is this a function of the current economic crisis, or is there something more structural and fundamental at play here?
Both, I think. It's exacerbated by the current crisis because the current crisis is doing terrible things to the job market. It's making more and more people vulnerable to losing their homes. It's pushing more and more people into situations where they have no health insurance and so on. So clearly the state of the economy isn't helping this. But it actually goes back way sort of further back. It goes back to this notion that we can solve all our problems just through letting the market do its work. And so over 30 or 40 years, we did a pretty good job at dismantling many of the social safety net provisions that the New Deal created to try and keep people out of hunger and out of poverty. So we let the minimum wage stagnate in value. We created an arbitrarily low definition of the poverty line, which meant that people who really were quite poor were deemed to be too affluent to qualify for government programs. We ceased to measure inflation accurately for people at the bottom of the economy who were spending more on basic necessities like food and healthcare and gas for their cars. And all of these things came together and sort of began percolating upwards. And the way I sort of look at it is that 30 years ago, Reagan promised America trickle-down prosperity. He basically said, look, if you adopt this model of tax cuts for the wealthy, government spending cuts for social programs, if you adopt this model, there'll be this trickle-down effect where money starts percolating downward from the top and everyone gets richer. And it seems to me that if you sort of look at this in a slightly more objective way without the sort of market ideology as a lens, that actually what happened was the reverse, that we had something which I'll call trickle-up poverty. So what we did is we basically created a situation that was untenable for the workers at the bottom of the economy. And their poverty then began percolating upwards and then impacting more people and impacting more basic structures of the economy. And I think in a sense, the economic crisis that unfolded at such speed last year, that's basically the coda to this story, that the story itself was developing in the shadows without many people paying attention to it for many, many years. And then suddenly it burst its confines, it burst its banks, and everyone got damaged. And that happened last year. It's still happening this year.
Talk about what happened during the 90s when we seemed to be in a boom economy and this appeared to be less of an issue.
Yeah, I mean, the 90s are interesting because Bill Clinton's the president. In some ways, he's got quite a progressive political agenda. And he's clearly got a team of experts who are managing the economy who are very, very talented in many ways, in considerable contrast to the people who both preceded him and followed him. But I think one of the things that happened under Bill Clinton's presidency was the country became increasingly seduced by the notion of growth based upon bubbles. So we became increasingly seduced by the idea that housing prices could just go up and up, that stock prices could go up and up, that the internet boom could just go on forever without ever having any kind of retrenchment. And as we got more and more addicted to a boom bubble version of economics, in a sense, our economy became less fundamentally stable. We created an illusion of high growth, but it was based on these very, very fragile bubble economies. And so I think, in a sense, we're suffering the hangover from that now. You know, we felt great while we were floating on these bubbles. It was like when you're at a party and you drink a lot, and for a while there you feel wonderful, but then you wake up the next day and you don't feel wonderful at all. You actually feel terrible. And I sort of think that that's where we are economically at the moment, that we forgot our history. We forgot that bubbles have a tendency of bursting. We thought that our bubbles were immortal, that they go on forever. And then they burst, and a whole bunch of people expressed shock and amazement. A whole bunch of senior political figures last year said, well, you know, we could never have predicted this. This was a once-in-a-century financial storm. And there were all these sort of disclaimers saying, don't blame us, it wasn't our fault, this was basically an act of God. And actually, nothing could be further from the truth. This was an entirely predictable crisis based largely upon the fact that we remodeled our economy around bubbles, that we decided that we could borrow our way to prosperity, that we didn't have to do the hard work. And that obviously wasn't true. And now we're seeing the consequences.
And talk a little bit about what happened to those people at the bottom, both during the bubbles and when the bubble burst.
Well, I have this notion that's sort of partly based just on, you know, my thinking about the issue, but it's mainly based upon my talking to an awful lot of people while I was researching this book, while I was researching other things. My idea is that bubbles tend to hurt the poorest people most, both when they're emerging and when they're popping. And the reason for that, let's take the housing bubble. For about 10 years, the housing market got hotter and hotter and hotter. And so all the incentives went into encouraging people to become homeowners. So you got these tremendous tax deductions if you could buy into property. You were lured in with the promise of low interest rates if you could pony up the down payment. And then if you couldn't pony up the down payment, you'd get all these secondary loans to bridge the gap. And so what seemed to happen was that people with money, people who'd long invested in property, they got into the housing market early enough that they benefited from the bubbles. And then the people who tried to get in at the end, when there was this mad scramble over the sort of 2002 to 2006 to buy into the market, those were people who generally were having a harder time putting together the down payment. They were the poorer part of the population. So they bought in late, which meant they bought in at inflated prices. And the only way they could buy in was on these absurd variable rate mortgages and these creative mortgages. And then when the bubble starts bursting, and basically you could look at this almost like a Ponzi scheme, that it's great as long as everyone's happy buying in, but as soon as a few people lose confidence, there's this mad scramble to get out. And as soon as that started happening, as soon as people tried to start divesting of bad investments in property, the market crashed. And the people who got hurt the most and the quickest, again, were the poorer people, because they had less rainy day funds to fall back on. They put everything into their houses. When the house was less valuable than what they bought it for, they went underwater. When the variable rates kicked in, they had no rainy day cushions to fall back on. And these are the people who started very, very quickly defaulting on their loans and going into foreclosure. And I think that's sort of true across the board, that the way we structured our economy, it left the poorer part of the population peculiarly vulnerable, and it left them peculiarly likely to fall into poverty when one or two of the parts of the equation changed. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is what we're seeing here, that, you know, we're seeing hunger in America not because there's crop failings, because there isn't. We're seeing hunger in America as a collateral consequence of other parts of the economy just failing to work.
To what extent did the welfare reform of the 90s impact on the social safety nets that were there?
I think to a fairly profound degree, that you what we did is we made a series of decisions as a society that our obligations to the poorest of the poor were not going to be as comprehensive as they had been in the past. And they'd never been particularly comprehensive. If you compare what we were providing as a safety net to what Canada provides or much of Western Europe provides, let's say, we'd always had a fairly meager safety net to begin with. But I think the reforms in the 90s, they were based around the assumption you could essentially move a lot of people off of welfare and painlessly absorb them into the labor market. And that worked when the economy was booming. It worked when employers were madly chasing after potential employees. But once the job market tightened, from 2001 on in, we had either recession or what was called jobless recovery. So once the job market tightened, the people at the bottom end of the economy were increasingly vulnerable, and they had nowhere to fall back on. The welfare system had been essentially dismantled in the 90s, or at least severely constricted. So an awful lot of people had no choice but to accept whatever minimum wage job was offered, and they didn't have any clout to push for a higher minimum wage. So for 10 years, from 1997 to 2007, federal minimum wage stayed at just over $5 an hour. And then inflation basically eroded its value. So what I think happened is that the political calculus became more cautious, more conservative around the safety net. The economic calculus became less forgiving for people at the bottom of the economy. And then when the economic equations just broke down for everybody last year, the ones who were already suffering, it went into overdrive. They really began skipping a lot of meals. They began skipping a lot of bills. They began going into foreclosure, losing their homes, losing their cars, having their utility bills cut off. And I think that's a pretty sort of poisonous, toxic brew, if you like.
And what role has public policy, particularly with respect to agricultural policy, played with regard to the food industry and how it's filtered down to this poverty issue?
Well, I think the government for over six decades at this point has massively subsidized industrial agriculture in this country, and that has good effects and it has bad effects. One of the good effects is we're more productive farming-wise than we've ever been in our history, than any country's ever been in its history. One of the bad effects is we're subsidizing the production of a huge amount of fatty, starchy, unhealthy foods that are based around corn produce in particular. So one of the things that does is it means if you're on the margins economically, you go for whatever food is cheapest. And that's no longer fresh fruit and vegetables. It's no longer even rice and beans. It's oftentimes junk food. It's oftentimes sodas, potato chips. It's oftentimes cheap fast food hamburgers and so on. And I'm sort of always loath to get on my high horse about what quality of food people should eat. I think that's a sort of secondary issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not Michael Pollan talking about the omnivore's dilemma. But I do think it's interesting that we, in a sense, have created this dysfunctional system where the cheapest, most easily available food is actually the most unhealthy food. And I think that's part of a conversation that we need to have when we're having this broader conversation about how to deal with hunger and how to deal with poverty.
What pressure has all of this put on the food banks and those private charities, churches, etc., the social safety net structure that is there now?
Huge pressure. I went up to a small town called Fort Jones in the far north of California when I was doing research for this book. And I talked with this is a place where people were just being hammered by the combination of high gas prices and low income. And I talked to a tremendous number of people who basically wouldn't be surviving if they weren't standing in lines at these sort of very small church-based often food pantries. And then I went to one of them and I talked to this elderly couple. They were called Billy and George McPherson, and they were in their 80s. And they basically decided they'd been hungry when they were growing up, and they remembered it and remembered how awful it felt. And they decided that now they were in their old age, they were going to try and alleviate some of the hardship their neighbors were going through. So they set up this food pantry, and they got some of their fellow church members involved in gathering up food and distributing it. And I asked Billy McPherson why she was doing this, and she said to me, well, look, for an increasing number of people who we know, the month is longer than the money. And I asked her what she meant by that, and she said, well, you know, we have all these people either on government fixed income, Social Security, let's say, or they're in these very low-paid jobs where they get paid, you know, $7, $8 an hour. And at the end of each pay cycle, these guys run out of money. And they know they're going to. They know that 5, 6, 7 days before the pay cycle ends, they're going to have no money in their bank account, and they're going to open their fridge one day, and it's going to be empty. And they're going to go to their pantry, and the shelves are going to be bare. And she said, these guys have no way around the fact that for them, the month is longer than the money. And they have nothing to fall back on apart from help, from charity. And I think that, you know, this is basically the conundrum that an increasing number of people are facing. They cannot make ends meet. It's not that they're doing anything wrong. They're not behaving irresponsibly. They're not going on spending sprees, and that's resulting in empty wallets. They're living frugally, and they're still unable to make ends meet. And when you sort of try and solve that problem through private charity, there's a huge problem there. The problem is that times are getting tougher. That means more and more people need help. And yet at the same time, there are fewer and fewer people available with the money to donate extra food. And so you end up, I spoke to a pantry group of pantry workers in northern Idaho, And they told me that there was this one period last year where they just ran out of food, and they were basically giving out frozen potatoes. And they had lines hours long. One person told me about an 87-year-old man standing in line for hours to get these meager supplies of free food because there was no alternative. The entire community was suffering. And I went to some communities in New Mexico. I went to communities in the Texas Panhandle, in Oklahoma, where literally half of the population of some of these small towns was now surviving only thanks to food being trucked in from regional food banks. And that's amazing to me. You know, it just is a profoundly disturbing realization.
And what impact have food stamps had?
Well, they're an important program. And when we talk about the sort of shredding of America's social safety net, in a sense, the one exception is food stamps. And I think that's because we had this sort of very coercive political debate around cash welfare. We had this sort of image of welfare queens driving to welfare agencies in Cadillacs to pick up their welfare checks. It was never true. It might have been true occasionally, but basically that was a stereotype. But it shaped the debate. We got very moralistic about a lot of poverty programs. But I don't think anyone really gets moralistic about food and poverty and hunger, or food and hunger, rather, because I think everybody knows someone who at some point has been hungry, at some point has fallen on hard times and needed some help with food. And it's a very sort of primal thing, in a way, that you don't let your neighbor go hungry. In my book, I say it's like spitting in the eye of God. There's just something very wrong with the notion of watching someone going hungry and not trying to intervene to help. And so I think for that reason, the food stamp system has been somewhat protected in recent years. And it actually these days is feeding a record number of Americans. It's feeding 32 million people. And you can sort of, you can look at that like the glass is half full or the glass is half empty. You can either say this is a good thing, it means the food stamp program is working. Or you can say, well, yeah, it's a good thing that it's working, but it's a terrible thing that 32 million people are now poor enough and destitute enough to only be able to survive with government food help. And then when you factor in the fact that about 1 in 3 people who are poor enough for food stamps just don't apply for many different reasons, That means there's another 10 or 12 million people out there who are dirt poor but who aren't getting food help. So I think the food stamp system is good, but it's not nearly sufficient.
And then, of course, we have huge numbers of children that are relying almost entirely on the free breakfast and lunches at schools to provide the only nutrition that they're getting.
That's right. And you go to some schools in places like Fresno in California, some of the inner city neighborhoods around the country, and you're literally at a point where 100% of the students are poor enough to qualify for breakfast and lunches. And, you know, again, you can take this two ways. It's obviously good those programs exist. They're an absolutely vital part of the social safety net. But it's absolutely heartbreaking that when you talk to these children, and I talked to a lot of them when I was reporting my book, when you talk to these children, they'll say to you, yeah, I go to school at 7 in the morning so I can get my free breakfast, and then I have my free lunch, and then I come home and my parents can't feed me. And I spoke to these young kids, 8 and 9 years old, who the only food they'd get when they came home from school would be dried cereal. They couldn't even afford milk for the cereal. They get nothing else, and then they'd go to school for their free food the next day. And I said, well, what do you do on the weekends? And they said, well, you know, we get dried cereal. We might sometimes get a little bit of fruit to eat, but we have no meat. We have, you know, no real protein. And I said, you know, what do you do in the summer holidays? Well, what happens is an increasing number of these people have to take their children to what are called summer feeding programs.
Right.
And these are programs set up in city parks and low-income neighborhoods where kids can hang around the park and they can get a free lunch or a free dinner. And I went to some of these parks in Idaho, and at 6 o'clock when the volunteers set up their tables, there'd be this rush of cars. They were usually these beaten-up old cars. And the parents would drive up, and the kids would hop out, and they'd run over, and they'd get their free corn dog or slice of pizza, and they'd jump back in the car, and they'd go home. And these were families who, again, they had nothing at home. And if these feeding programs didn't exist, the kids would be going not just mildly hungry, but they'd literally be missing the bulk of their meals. And, you know, this is something that is such a huge problem at this point, because so many families are struggling to make ends meet, that I really think, you know, it's one of the great underrepresented challenges that's facing us as a country.
What do we have to do in terms of public policy beyond, obviously, the broader economy having to turn around? But even that will still leave large numbers in this situation.
That's right. I think there's no single fix. It'd be wonderful to say, well, if you just created this particular food program, or you just expanded access to food stamps, everything would be solved. And it's just not how it works. This is a problem that is going to involve people working from a huge number of different policy points. There are going to have to be people who are experts in food working on this. There are going to have to be minimum wage experts. There are going to have to be people who know how to protect pension systems so that elderly people who've been promised pensions don't suddenly fall into destitution when companies go bankrupt. There's going to have to be some kind of policies put forward to protect poor rural workers in particular when gas prices spike. Because otherwise what you're going to see is what happened last summer and what looks to be happening again this summer, huge surges in gas prices literally eating up an entire disposable income for a poor family. And families are literally having to choose between filling their car with gas to drive to work or buying food for their kids. And since they have to be able to get to work, because otherwise they can't pay the housing and everything else, generally it's food that gives. So I'd say that this is one of these sort of, it's like an octopus. It's got all these different tentacles, and they're going off in all these different directions. And the only way to really tackle hunger is to realize that it is this multi-tentacled beast and to approach it from all these different points. And, even then, this is obviously not something that will disappear overnight. We're going to have this problem as a legacy of the last 30 years of failed economic policies. We're going to have this problem for many, many, many years. But I think we need to make a good faith effort to start dealing with it. And part of that involves acknowledging it. We need to actually acknowledge that under the surface, many tens of millions of Americans are in severe anxiety about how they're going to feed themselves.
Sasha Abramski, the book is Breadline USA, The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger and How to Fix It. It's just out from Polypoint Press. Sasha, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Hey, thank you.